Thank you all for being here, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Kevin Casasamora, a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Program and the Latin American Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Following the horrific tragedy that took place in Haiti 5 weeks ago, in which more than 200,000 people appear to have perished, we at Brookings hosted a first roundtable to discuss the nature and prospects of the relief effort in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake. That panel was noteworthy for many, many reasons, and one of the panelists called the earthquake the greatest urban disaster in history, a stunning reminder of the magnitude of the crisis. Another panelist, a relief worker with vast experience and with previous tours in Darfur and Bosnia, among other places, I mean, that is someone who has been around and has seen a lot, simply broke in tears, giving his recollection of the disaster. That was indeed a sobering moment. One of the themes that came out quite clearly out of this panel in many different ways was the idea that the political and institutional collapse of Haiti quite clearly predated the earthquake. That in a way, the extensive damage inflicted on Haiti by the earthquake was a symptom of the country's institutional collapse rather than the other way around. All the panelists agreed that rebuilding what one of them called a phantom state was key, arguably the key, to the long-term success of development efforts in Haiti. To this effect, some options have been floated, ranging from some kind of UN-led trusteeship to some kind of compact between Haiti and key stakeholders in the international community. But the fact remains that to this day, the issue of Haiti's future governance seems to be shrouded in doubt. Quite frankly, the international community seems to be at a loss as to how to deal with this absolutely key issue. To talk about Haiti's future governance and what the options are to make Haiti governable and therefore amenable to successful development efforts, we have assembled a great panel, a great team of experts whose members are, quite luckily for us, all related to Brookings. To my immediate left, we have Elizabeth Ferris. She's a senior fellow in foreign policy and co-director of the Brookings Institution, University of Bern Project on Internal Displacement. There, her work encompasses a wide range of issues related to forced migration, human rights, humanitarian action, the role of civil society in protecting displaced populations, and the security implications of displacement. Prior to joining Brookings in 2006, Dr. Ferris spent 20 years working in the field of humanitarian assistance, most recently in Geneva with the World Council of Churches. And besides that, she has published extensively on humanitarian issues. To her left is my good friend and colleague, Mauricio Cárdenas. Mauricio is a senior fellow and director of the Latin America Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Before joining Brookings, Mauricio served as executive director of FEDESarrollo, an independent, policy-oriented research center in Bogota, Colombia, that ranks among the most important think tanks in Latin America. He also served in the Colombian government, both as Minister of Transportation, Director of National Planning, and also Minister of Economic Development. He's currently the president of the Latin American and Caribbean Economic Association, LACEA, and really, the list of his publications on development issues is very long indeed. And on the extreme left of the panel, extreme right from your perspective, is Jean-Marie Guijeno. He's a senior fellow also at the Brookings Institution and at the Center on International Cooperation at New York University. He currently serves as the chairperson of the Advisory Board of the United Nations Institute for Training and Research, UNITAR. He's also a member of the board of the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue in Geneva. Even more germane to this discussion, he was the Undersecretary, the UN Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations from 2000 to 2008. And therefore, he became the longest-serving head of peacekeeping. He led the biggest expansion of peacekeeping in the history of the United Nations. Before joining the UN, he also had a distinguished career in the French government and in the private sector. He was the director of policy planning in the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs from 1989 to 1993. And, you know, I could go on telling how knowledgeable this panel is. I'm going to ask each member of the panel to speak for 15 minutes sharp, and then we will open up the discussion to the audience, and I'm sure we will have, a very spirited discussion the same way that we did when we had our first panel in Haiti. Beth, the microphone is yours.
Thank you very much. I'm going to be speaking from the perspective of a humanitarian, looking at the massive needs of reconstruction and recovery in Haiti, before getting to the question on this panel, which is, does Haiti need some kind of a protectorate or a trusteeship status, which I do not support, by the way. But if you look at the whole history of major natural disasters in the last 20 years, this is more or less what would happen if it's business as usual in responding to the earthquake in Haiti. Media attention will diminish. It's already diminishing. There will be a gap between the amount of money pledged and the actual amount that is received as donors have other priorities and other needs emerge. There will be a scramble by well-meaning and generally well-resourced NGOs, probably hundreds, perhaps thousands of NGOs, who will come to Haiti to assist for the best of motivations, but with little concrete incentive to coordinate their actions with others. You see, I think a strong UN country team that's perhaps better coordinated than in other kinds of disasters. And yet it's a UN country team that faces incredible pressures, given the immensity of the needs, the proliferation of actors, and the very nature of the humanitarian system, which is far from a command and control model, but it's a model that's based on a very soft kind of persuasion, collaboration, often pleading. The UN's emergency relief coordinator, John Holmes, does not sit in a room with a control panel where he can push a button and say, tents are needed here, or settlement should be set up there, or can anybody move the latrine plates a little bit faster? It's a different kind of system. So the UN, I think, is doing a great job, but the odds against it are tremendous. There will be a deluge of money. The amount of money that's been raised so far is impressive, perhaps not as impressive given the monumental needs. But given the way in which donor cycles work, particularly for humanitarian response, there will be pressure to spend that money quickly, pressure to transfer that money to organizations which may not have the capacity to use it widely, leading then to media stories, which are almost inevitable, about the diversion of aid, corruption, etc., therefore justifying, in the minds of some donors at least, you know, the reduction of funds from the amounts that were pledged. There will be, and there has already been, a lot of talk, perhaps a lot of rhetoric, about the importance of being in Haiti for the long haul, about the need to have a smooth transition from relief to development. But frankly, we haven't gotten it right just about anywhere. The humanitarians are so busy with their life-saving activities of trying to scrape together enough plastic sheeting and get water delivered that it's hard to have the energy or the creativity or the time to even think about what is needed for the long term. And yet we know that decisions that are being made right now will have an impact down the line in terms of Haiti's long-term recovery and reconstruction. And finally, if all goes according to the scenario I've laid out, and I certainly hope it doesn't, but if it does move in that direction, in a year or two, we'll be faced with kind of this sad feeling of guilt that once again, Haiti has been let down, and that the aid system, the humanitarian system, the development system hasn't been able to adequately meet the needs of this most impoverished country in this hemisphere. So when you step back and think, what is needed to help change this business as usual model to ensure that perhaps things are different this time in Haiti, several points come to mind. First of all, the need to support Haitian political institutions. And this gets to the point that Kevin made where almost a collective feeling of despair about the weakness of some of Haiti's political structures. But there's no way around it. There's no way of bypassing the government and setting up something completely different that has a chance of being sustainable. This means that there's a need for capacity building at every stage of the process. Of Haitian political institutions and civil society institutions. I'm sure you're reading the same kind of stories we are, but some of the accounts of what's happening at the community level, of grassroots leadership emerging, are really inspiring. And if there's a way of building and tapping into that capacity, we'd all be well served. There's a need for long-term sustained commitment by donors. And along with that, the need for serious long-term planning over the next decade. And Haiti here, of course, is not starting from scratch. Some of the work that was done earlier last year, for example, is a good basis for doing that long-term economic planning. I would suggest some other things that are needed are heightened ways of strengthening coordination between NGOs, perhaps even enforcing coordination. I come from an NGO background, so please don't jump on me. Last week, OCHA, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, released a report that said something over 900 NGOs had indicated to OCHA they were working in the country, but only about 100 had told them where they were working or what they were doing. We need strong UN leadership here, and we need the Haitian government to set some standards. Otherwise, the competition between different organizations can create conflict and resentment. In Aceh, following the tsunami, there was almost an open bidding war between humanitarian organizations building homes and people in desperate need of housing. You know, Organization X was offering a two-room house, and Organization Y, you get a three-room house. It was when the government of Aceh came in and said, "This is the standard. You will construct your houses with X number of square feet," it really prevented or diminished that kind of competition. The private sector, particularly the construction industry, could be mobilized. And here I have hopes for former Presidents Clinton and Bush and their ability to reach out to the private sector in new and creative ways. The role of the diaspora has been mentioned in the media as offering the potential for providing, strengthening the human capacity in the recovery process. And there are some ways of doing that, but also some sensitivities. You know, it's hard when people have lived outside the country for a number of years to come back in with answers and support, but perhaps more could be done here. One way of doing this or meeting these needs, which I would advocate, although it's not an original idea. My colleague here, Brookings, I think, proposed it a couple of weeks ago, and that's the call for creating a Haitian reconstruction agency or authority, and perhaps to be somewhat creative and to build on the model that was used in Aceh, where the Aceh Reconstruction and Rehabilitation Agency was amazingly successful in channeling some $7 billion in long-term support for Aceh. And even though we think of Indonesia as having a strong government, certainly at the time there were a lot of concerns about mismanagement, corruption, and so forth. But the way in which the agency was structured and functioned served to reassure donors, to allay some of those concerns, and to channel funds to provide for substantial rebuilding in Aceh, a place that was, of course, devastated by the tsunamis. In thinking about what such a Haitian reconstruction agency would look like, I mean, it needs to be Haitian-led, to have a long mandate, perhaps 10 years, to be separate from the humanitarian community, because as I said, the humanitarians have to be focused on delivery of life-saving assistance, but to build in mechanisms for liaison from the beginning. If you look at the model in Aceh, where this the BRR, it was called, had an executive agency, then it had two different committees, an advisory group that was made up of representatives of local governments and civil society to kind of socialize the decision-making process, and then a supervisory board that included representatives of key donors, which also played a role in decision-making about how the money was to be spent. Some model like that, that might include, for example, the World Bank or Inter-American Development Bank, might reassure donors enough to keep the needed funds flowing. Within such an agency, it would be important to have some department to set these basic standards for how and where and when and using what materials reconstruction would take place. Such an agency could also develop a registry and a process for using the talents of the diaspora. And in terms of priorities, I mean, it could work. I'm very worried about civil defense in response to the hurricanes, which are coming right now, and I would make that a priority. Many have suggested to focus on livelihoods, employment, jobs, and that's been a mantra we've seemed to discuss at every disaster. There's an opportunity right now in Haiti, given the fact that over 500,000 people have left the capital for rural areas and smaller towns, to build on that, to provide services in those regions, to kind of counter the perhaps excessive centralization that has characterized much of Haiti's development. So there are opportunities right now. And finally, just to say a word about protectorates, and I think protectorate is the wrong term to be using in the year 2010. It reeks of a colonial heritage, which hopefully we've passed. I think anything that related to a protectorate or a trusteeship would be assumed to be, even if it weren't the case, to be U.S. dominated. The U.S. has a particular history not only in Latin America, but especially in Haiti. Not just the fact that U.S. military was there for almost 20 years, but a whole history of relations with Haitian migrants and strong disparities in treatment of Haitians and Cubans arriving in the same kind of rickety vessels in the same places that people remember. Every time in the past, the UN has set up models to provide transitional administration, Kosovo, East Timor, Cambodia. Those have been, following conflicts and on the basis of peace agreements. To set up something similar after a natural disaster, I think would create disturbing precedents. Think of Myanmar, Burma. Think of Hurricane Katrina in terms of the ability of national governments to protect and assist their people. I think the idea of protectorate or trusteeship sounds attractive because it sounds like a way of providing needed services and bypassing the Haitian government. But I think that we have to take the slower road, perhaps more patient road, of working with the institutions that exist to support them. Otherwise, they won't be sustained. Thanks.
Thank you, Beth. Mauricio.
Thank you, Kevin. Well, let me begin this first round, these 10 minutes, with some remarks on the context of Haiti. I think we have to think about where was Haiti standing before the earthquake to really be able to assess the ability to move forward and to put together all the initiatives and the planning that is necessary for the reconstruction. And I say these because we tend to think of Haiti in very negative terms in terms of economic development, but it's important that we are all aware that the irony of this earthquake is that it took place precisely when Haiti was putting its act together, when Haiti was actually showing improvements in many areas. So we must not forget that things were getting better. And let me illustrate this with a few examples. Last year's economic growth in Haiti, it's estimated to have been 2.9%. These at a year when most of the countries were experiencing contractions. Haiti was able to grow. Last year's foreign direct investment into Haiti surpassed $500 million, which was a historical high, meaning that some of the initiatives and the policy framework that had been adopted was generating some confidence on the part of investors. One of the big projects that was initiated last year was the development of a new port for the cruise lines that operate in the Caribbean. And this was going to be one of the three largest cruise ports in the Caribbean. Inflation, which had affected Haiti for years, had been declining. And the same, we all know, was the case on security measures, incidents of different types of crime, homicide rates, robberies, etc. And I would also mention that although Haiti is known to rank in very low levels in terms of the governance indicators, when you look at the evolution of those governance indicators throughout time, and we know that they're available since the mid-90s, thanks to the World Bank Governance Indicators Project led by Danny Kaufman, who is actually one of our colleagues here at Brookings. When we look at those measures, and they split governance into five different categories, the interesting fact, it's not just that Haiti ranks very low, but that there is an improvement, that Haiti had been improving. Think, for example, in one measure which we hear about all the time, which is the control of corruption. The control of corruption measure, which has the lowest value is minus 2.5, according to the World Bank's indicators, was, you know, at the one of the lowest levels in Haiti at around the beginning of this decade, but in the last measurement, it was just about minus one. The same can be said about the rule of law, political stability and no violence. That's another measure of governance. The government effectiveness, which is, I guess, the ability of the state to initiate policies, to execute policies, to implement them, had also been showing signs of improvement. And the last measure is voice and accountability. That's those are the measures of the governance project of the World Bank. That measure also showed signs of improvement. It's not to say that Haiti was doing very well. It's not that it was it was no longer one of the countries in the world with the lowest scores, but it was at least showing better scores than it had shown by the beginning of this decade. So it's important that we take this into consideration. And we also should add to this picture of the context and the initial landscape two additional elements. One is that last year, we probably didn't hear about it because it was not in the headlines, but there was a very successful meeting for Haiti in terms of the reduction of debt. Haiti owed about $2 billion, $1.9 billion, prior to last year's summer. And as a result of these efforts to reduce the debt and the write-downs, the debt of Haiti had been lowered to about $800 million. And on top of this, the U.S. Congress passed various forms of legislation creating special access to the U.S. market for Haitian goods through the HOPE and HOPE 2 initiatives. Essentially, these are mechanisms that reduce tariffs for manufactured goods and particularly for garments. There was some discussion, and there's still some discussion, about the effectiveness of these tools. because the rule of origins, the rules of origin, remain strict and reduce the capacity really to use these incentives. But they show that there was interest on the part of the U.S. to create a mechanism that will allow the development of certain types of manufactured goods in Haiti. So this is Haiti prior to the earthquake. Then we had the devastating news from the earthquake, and I think all the attention has been focused, rightly so, in the humanitarian aspects of aid and essentially of dealing with a situation that was chaotic, to say the least, not only because more than 200,000 people died, but also because it's estimated that at least 300,000 had very severe injuries, and that 3 million out of a population of 10 million had some form of direct or indirect effect because of the earthquake. So this is devastating, and of course, all the attention at the beginning has to go in the areas related to assistance and humanitarian aid. But I think it's now time to think about the future, and it's now time to think about the reconstruction. And I think that's the central aspect in the discussion. And I think one way of characterizing the situation is that countries or regions that have experienced dramatic natural disasters in the past have also shown that after the reconstruction takes place, there is the possibility of getting or putting things in a situation that it's better than what things were before the natural disaster. Another way of putting this is that the crisis can become an opportunity, and that there is evidence that well-managed natural disasters can actually work as catalysts that help solve some of the pre-existing problems. And I think that's kind of like the challenge that we have in the case of Haiti. Now, how can that be done? And what are the risks ahead? I think there are two types of issues here. One is, in the short run, how to generate income and employment opportunities also for the Haitian population. For some time, people are going to live on aid. We have evidence of the importance of these of the support that the population is getting in terms of food consumption, in terms of shelter from the donors. But soon there'll be the need to have domestic sources of income, and that means getting back the economy on track and getting the economy operating again. The first thing, and rightly so, that the Haitian government did was to restore the system of payments. We don't think very frequently about that, except when we have a major financial crisis like what happened last year. But in Haiti, of course, after the earthquake, there was an interruption in the system of payments because the banks were not operating, and that of course, created many, many economic difficulties. Fortunately, that's working again. And that's an important step to have the economy functioning. But still, there is the need of employment. The Haitian government had put together last year a task force to figure out which were the sectors that Haiti could develop to become more competitive and to get more resources from exports. And those sectors pointed in the direction of tourism, the garments industry, fruits, and now another element is added to this package of sectors that it's considered central for economic growth, which is urban development, essentially the reconstruction of Port-au-Prince, not just in terms of housing construction, but also in terms of public infrastructure. So these are the topics that the Haitian government has decided will concentrate on. Now, it's well known that before the earthquake, and more so after the earthquake, Haiti had serious problems with public infrastructure, particularly in the fields of water and sanitation and in transport. So one aspect that has to be given absolute priority to get the economy going again is the reconstruction of these infrastructure. Of course, these requires some planning, and these requires some work in terms of the preparation of the of these projects. But these are top priorities. And in terms of housing, it's also well known that Port-au-Prince was suffering from two major problems prior to the earthquake. One was excessive inflows of migrants from the rural areas. The rate of population growth in Port-au-Prince was 2.5 times greater than the rate of growth of the population of Haiti as a whole. So we see, you know, a very strong force towards urbanization. And that, of course, with a very limited public infrastructure in the city of Port-au-Prince, resulted in a lot of people living in conditions that are unacceptable. No access to water, very poor housing, housing being developed in areas that were very risky, as we just had the evidence of, and also lack of employment opportunities. Too much informality, too many people selling in the streets. So that, of course, added to these problems of development in the city of Port-au-Prince. So now it's the time to think about, in the grand scheme of things, a new design for Port-au-Prince and for development of Haiti. Ideally, as Elizabeth was saying, this could balance growth between the city of Port-au-Prince and the rural areas, and ideally some of these other opportunities could actually be developed for in terms of incomes and employment outside Port-au-Prince. Of course, that's a challenge because if the infrastructure is weak in Port-au-Prince, it's even weaker in the rural area. So it's easier to say than really to actually implement policies to balance out, in regional terms, development in Haiti. But there are some possibilities. And one possibility that can be explored is the development of free trade zones or special economic zones along the border with the Dominican Republic, especially economic zones that use some of the public services from the Dominican Republic, like electricity, which is a major restriction, but also ports and roads from the Dominican Republic, but still generate employment for the Haitian population. So these special economic zones could be strategically located outside Port-au-Prince in the along the border, and could actually help to deal with this situation. And that, in part, could be the result of this new cooperation that is emerging between the Dominican Republic and Haiti. We just had evidence of a joint meeting in Santo Domingo this past week between the two governments. Another element that should be considered in the reconstruction efforts is the need to some extent provide additional relief to the population by allowing more Haitians to migrate. This is something that it's contested. Not everyone likes this alternative, but think of what would happen to New Orleans if there had not been Interstate 10 allowing people to move and to reduce some of these immediate pressures that result after after a natural disaster. So allowing for more migration could be a way of helping, not just by reducing those pressures locally, but also by providing more resources in the form of remittances. The evidence that we have is overwhelming in terms of the importance of remittances for supporting people's living standards. So one possible measure could be to ask both the U.S. and the European governments to provide additional visas, could be temporary visas, for Haitian migrants. Last year, the U.S. granted 20,000 visas for Haitians, and that number could be increased to 50,000. And the U.S. and the European Union could do about the same. And that could be a way of helping, and it would be a form of relief. And finally, in this last minute, let me touch on the issue of the protectorate. And well, that's in my view, it's unthinkable of. I think that the major reason is that the Haitians have elected a legitimate government under democratic institutions that has limitations. That, of course, is a government that suffers from weak state capacity. But rather than replacing the government with an outsider, I think what the international community has to do is to complement the Haitian government. So then the discussion should be about how to complement and how to help the Haitian government so that out of this crisis, the Haiti finds not only new elements and new sources of economic growth, but at the same time, it accelerates its path into improving governance. And how can we use this crisis to enhance state capacity? So one way of doing this is by expanding the role of the UN mission, maybe through the creation of a special agency that has as a mandate not just the peacekeeping operations, but also some other aspects. For example, the provision of health or public infrastructure or the building of schools, but in close coordination with the Haitian government. So it's an expansion of the mandate of the UN mission with greater roles, with greater responsibilities, but also under clear guidelines for cooperation with the Haitian government. So that that special agency from the UN that could be created to deal with this situation could be led by someone that understands the sensitivities associated with the presence in Haiti, but at the same time, someone that has the stature coordinate all the donors. And it has been mentioned, in fact, it's mentioned today in the press in Spain, in Chile, in Brazil, the possibility that the Latin American governments led by Brazil that already has a strong presence in Haiti and it's been playing quite an important role in Haiti, that position is occupied by a former president of a Latin American country like Michelle Bachelet from Chile. That could actually help the coordination without challenging the political institutions in Haiti. And that could be also a way of sending a message to the donor community that these resources that have been pledged are going to be put into good use. So I will leave these comments at this stage just to suggest that between the two extremes of a protectorate and other people that are calling, like Bill Easterly from NYU, that the money should be given directly to the local communities, bypassing the national government, there is an intermediate option. And this intermediate option means let's empower the national government of Haiti, but let's support it with a special agency from the UN led by a someone that has credibility in the international community.
Thank you, Mauricio. There are plenty of intermediate options, actually. Jean-Marie, please.
Okay, well, a lot has been said, so that's the advantage when one speaks last, is can just concur with the previous speakers. I would want to start with what Kevin said on the magnitude of the catastrophe, because Haiti is this rather unique country where the capital represents a third of the country. And so to have the capital of a very weak, very fragile state destroyed by an earthquake, there is no precedent in history of such a situation. And so we can talk of natural catastrophes, all that, but the capital, one third of the country destroyed, that raises questions that there is no comparison, there is no precedent. Now, first point on security. Immediately in the aftermath of the earthquake, there was a lot of talk, you know, of the the violence that was going to erupt, and the TV channels were showing always the same images of a few people looting. And indeed, I mean, this was the rational thing to do when you have nothing and there is there are some goods somewhere that you need. You take them. What is remarkable, actually, in the aftermath of the earthquake is how little violence there has been in Haiti, contrary to the kind of prejudice that exists. And that's very important, including for the future for reconstruction, because it points to one thing that is often underestimated, which is the strength of local communities in Haiti. And certainly, you want to build on that strength rather than ignore it. And that is relevant for something I'll discuss later. And it's the reconstruction, including the urban reconstruction. At the same time, and that's the bad news, as was said before, there had been some progress in security, but that progress was very much linked to major efforts made by a combination of the Haitian National Police, the troops of MINUSTA and the police of MINUSTA and also intelligence to arrest a number of gangs. And so a number of gangs in Haiti had been dismantled. Now, during the earthquake, the jail, which was overcrowded like all jails in Haiti, was broken. Sorry, I'm at the end of a cold. Was broken, and so everybody escaped. And that's a short-term, but possibly a very serious issue. Because, the criminality in Haiti had been evolving in recent years and had not been evolving for the good. On the one hand, the MINUSTA had been able to crack down on the gangs, and hence the improvement. On the other hand, there were more connections with organized crime from drug lords of Latin America. And that's extremely dangerous because that's a different order of magnitude in terms of the money involved, a different level of violence, too. And there was a fear that Haiti could become a kind of base, for transformation of products and then shipping them, flying them to the United States and Canada. And that created serious concerns in Haiti. And certainly in the aftermath of the earthquake, you don't want the progress that had been made in reversing that dangerous evolution to be overturned. And so there is an immediate effort that needs to be made to make sure that the gangs do not reconstitute, do not take advantage of the situation, and do not connect with international organized crime, for which Haiti is an interesting base. The second point I would want to make is on politics. And in a way, it's an extension of what was said before about protectorates and trusteeships and all that. In the international community, we have a tendency to think that the shortest route is the best route. I'm not sure it was the best route in Kosovo. I'm not sure it was the best route in Timor, actually. There's a lot to be said on those two experiences, which I had to oversee them when I was at the UN. I'm definitely convinced that in the case of Haiti, because of the history of Haiti, it's an absurd idea. Haiti is a very polarized country. There is, if you look at it in economic terms, the Gini coefficient in Haiti is one of the worst in the world. If you look at it socially, you have what the Haitian call, using the French word, but I mean Haitian meaning, I mean what they call la bourgeoisie, which is really a small group of people living on the heights of Port-au-Prince, and which until recently controlled the economy in a kind of oligopolistic manner, including imports, control of the harbor, so that common products, you know, a piece of soap or something like that, would be basically as expensive or more expensive often in Haiti than if you bought it here in New York. I remember having an interesting dinner with some of the representatives of that bourgeoisie, and they were confronted to a very tricky choice. I mean, were they ready to enlarge the pie and lose control over it, or would they rather stay with a very small pie and keep control over it? That's basically their dilemma. And one of the political problems of Haiti is that over time they have made the second choice, keeping the pie small but with full control over it. Now, as was just said, there were very positive signs in the last 18 months. That indeed a number of Haitians, from that economic elite, understood that maybe, after all, it was better to enlarge the pie, even at the risk of losing some control of it, over it, rather than keeping it small. And that was, in part, actually linked to their fear of the drug lords. That they saw that a country that was so insecure, that created so much fear, of course, didn't bring outside investment, which was a good thing from their standpoint, but at the same time, it could bring the wrong kind of investment, drug lords. And so, on balance, between having bodyguards to accompany your children and to provide security for your house and having a more normal situation, the balance was of advantages and disadvantages was slowly changing. And what is at stake now is really to reinforce that trend in the wake of the earthquake, which has broken everything, physical infrastructure, but also physical control. And so in that sense, yes, I think it can be, this horrible crisis can be, if well managed, an opportunity. But again, not with a trusteeship, because the Haitians have, they're very proud of having been, having through force of arms, won their independence before any other Caribbean country by defeating the troops of Napoleon. They paid dearly for that, because when there was the restoration, part of the agreement was that they would pay compensation to France. Essentially, that happened, that lasted through the whole 19th century. It was a drag on the economy. So they have deep suspicions of rich and powerful countries. And then there was the U.S. occupation from 1915 to 1934. And it's interesting, actually, when one thinks of trusteeships, of looking at them in that particular moment, which did bring some positive things to Haiti. I mean, a lot of people would recognize that there were efforts in building infrastructures, that in the Artibonite, which is a rice-producing part of Haiti, a lot of irrigation, all that was done with U.S. support. At the same, so in a way, the hardware was improved. But the software was made worse because the alliance of the United States with the local elite consolidated the already existing polarization. So The physical infrastructure was improved. The political infrastructure that would have made that improvement sustainable was made worse. And I think we have to think about that when we think of trusteeship. So what needs to be done? I think, and we all are sort of grappling with the issue, yes, we need to find some structure to manage the interface between the international community and Haiti. I think, like the previous speakers, I think one has to be very careful to make sure that the Haitian government is in the lead, that it is not, and that the leaders do not appear as any competition. The leaders of the interface do not appear, I mean, the international part does not appear as a competition to the Haitian leadership. Otherwise, there will immediately be a backlash and it would not be effective. So maybe you can have something that is a Haitian-led but with a secretariat that can be provided by the United Nations as an umbrella, because the United Nations probably has more legitimacy than any other organization from a political standpoint in Haiti. At the same time, for some of the development aspects, I would think that there are more resources in the Inter-American Development Bank, certainly that there is in the UN. So you probably need to combine in a creative way different organizations such as the UN, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and then, you know, the bilateral aid that the U.S. can provide, that the European Union can provide as, I mean, as the Commission, I mean, as, the, as an entity. And the key point is a political one, to structure it in a way that puts the Haitians right in the center. Now, what needs to be managed? The diaspora, it was mentioned. They are, again, very sensitive because there has been, the Haitian passed a law years ago to prevent double nationality. They don't like the notions that Haitians from the diaspora are going to tell them what to do. You need probably the diaspora, if it can work with the agency, probably better, probably more acceptable. What kind of aid? I certainly would support the notion of special economic zone, and I think, you know, one of the things we must do is do no harm. That is, make sure that in our agricultural policies, in our industrial, tariffs, we create real incentives for foreign investment to come to Haiti. And probably some insurance scheme is necessary because of the high risk of investments in Haiti. Lastly, and I will conclude on that, although I mentioned it passing before concluding, balance between Port-au-Prince and the countryside, balance between Port-au-Prince and the other big cities of Haiti. Yes, very important, but do not in the process destroy the communities that exist in Port-au-Prince. And so don't have some kind of grand urbanization renewal scheme that ignores the social fabric that exists, because then you will have a more unmanageable city, more unmanageable communities than what you have. But in conclusion, what I would say is that one of the most important contributions that the international community can do, and probably there the UN has a role to play, is help the Haitians move toward more effective political institutions. This year, there were supposed to be three elections, legislative, presidential, and a constitutional reform. So that's obviously not going to happen. There are presently discussions on how to manage that situation. There's a great fear among the Haitians that, whether it's linked to the dictatorship of Duvalier, so that leads to sometimes paralysis between the parliament and the executive. One need to have probably more effective institutions that allow for leadership, and also needs to have, and that's a key point on the rule of law, the judiciary. The judiciary is an area that is very corrupt. It's also a symbol of sovereignty. And so the reform of judiciary, which is very important if you want to have international investments, the reform of the judiciary is a key element Well, there also, I think, the international community can help. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Jean-Marie. Well, that's terrific. That's a lot to chew on. And I'll abuse the privilege of the chair to ask one question to kick off the discussion. I like the idea of the reconstruction agency, except, of course, that this is not just about rebuilding homes and infrastructure. It's also about rebuilding institutions. And that's why I find rather intriguing the experience of a place like Timor-Leste, where, in a way, the state had to be built from scratch. And in a way that, as far as I understand, the state, the local authorities were not replaced. Actually, you know, they were part of the deal. And I'm just wondering, I mean, whether it matters that this is not a post-conflict situation. In the end, I would think what matters is that here you have a state that has no ability whatsoever to provide public goods, including security, which, in a way, poses the question that perhaps there's a certain responsibility to protect, in a way. This is a tricky notion. But in the end, my question is to Jean-Marie, how relevant is the experience of Timor-Leste in particular to what's happening in Haiti? What aspects of that experience are relevant and could be put to good use in Haiti?
Well, I think first one should think of what wasn't done right in Timor-Leste and learn from that. Because in Timor-Leste, there was insufficient, I mean, the issues of Timor-Leste were just seen as the issues of Timor-Leste, I mean, freed from, I mean, Indonesian domination. When in reality, there were lots of undercurrents within Timor-Leste, between the East Timorese, that were ignored. And when the crisis came several years after the UN, when the mission was packing, it showed that more attention should have been paid to those internal Timor-Leste political issues, and that the fact that they were glossed over was a major problem. Second, and it's linked to the first, in Timor-Leste, there was technical efforts to make for a better police. There was no coordination between the police and the military. Well, in Haiti, the problem doesn't arise because there's no military. But in the police, there was insufficient attention, again, paid to the underlying political issues, which also led to a very fragile, actually, reform. And so I think the lesson we have to learn is that, indeed, the reform of the security sector, the reform of the rule of law sector, that is the police, the judiciary, the corrections, is a top priority in Haiti, but it has to be done with one's political eyes, so to speak, wide open. If it is seen just as a technical exercise, it will not work, in my view. The other thing where then we can maybe learn a lesson from Timor-Leste is there was great attention paid, and that was a good thing that the UN did, to the cabinet process. We always talk of national ownership. But I mean, what does it mean in practice? It means for the nationals, for the host country, to be able to define its priorities. Where do you define priorities in a country? In the cabinet. You say, okay, I'm going to spend this on education, that on agriculture. That's the normal process of decision-making in any country. What we see is that this is not an area that is very fashionable among development actors because it's not very visible, but it's a strategic area. And certainly helping the Haitian government develop the capacity to prioritize, so as to have a strong dialogue with the international community, I think that would be something helpful. In a way, the same way it was done when Ashraf Ghani was the finance minister in Afghanistan and was a tough interlocutor for the international community because he was in a position to prioritize and he knew what to ask from international institutions because he had worked in one of them. And We need to build interlocutors to help build interlocutors in Haiti who will be tough interlocutors for us.
Thank you. Okay, so now is the audience's turn. We'll take four questions, two from this side and two from that side, to make it democratic. And I will only ask you to identify yourselves and to say your institutional affiliation if you have one prior to posing your question. So let's go over there. Yeah, well, it's okay. I mean, ask your question, and then we'll go behind you.
Am I waiting for a microphone? Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. I'm happy to talk in the microphone. I have no problems with that. Patricia Fagan, Georgetown University. It seems as a consensus at the table that the notion of a colonial-type protectorate is off the table, that everybody is saying the Haitian government has to be somewhere in the center, but also needs some kind of support, lest international resources come pouring into Haiti and be given to people who will not be able, not have the human capital or the previous experience to be able to manage that money effectively and for the benefit of the country. I hope I'm not simplifying. Now, the last sentence was about capacity to prioritize, and it's on the level of capacities that I want to ask my question. At some point, when the UN Committee or the Reconstruction Committee or whatever other entity is established and goes away, it works and goes away, Haitian officials have to have better capacities all through the system, locally and nationally, than they have today. So do any of you have a recipe, a plan for building further capacities while the transition period is ongoing? Thank you.
Thank you. Over there. Yes.
Gregory Simpkins, the Leon Sullivan Foundation. It's said in real estate that the most important thing is location, location, and location. Given the fact that the tectonic plates that caused the earthquake are more active now, and geologists say that we can expect more aftershocks and other earthquakes, the fact that Haiti is perennially in the hurricane path every year, which starts in June, and the fact that the terrain generally is less favorable than the other half of the island on which the Dominican Republic sits, to what extent would you say that we need to take these factors into account when rebuilding Haiti or redesigning Haiti for the future?
Thank you. Here.
Sandra Dupuis. I was wondering, I'd like to hear a little bit more spoken about the agricultural sector. Given the fact that nearly 80% of the population lives in the rural areas and the environmental degradation that Haiti has suffered and the failure of investment for the past 50 years in that sector and the recent history with food security issues, is there any consideration being given by the international community to increase the capacity of that sector to secure the population? And also, with respect to building state capacity, I'm curious about the elite and the interface between the economic elite and the political elite, and the capacity to increase that dialogue so that they can work from the same hymn book or sing from the same hymn book, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Over there. Yes. Wait for the mic.
My name is Deborah Owens. I'm the UN Peacekeeping Liaison Officer to USAID for Haiti. Brookings didn't get where it is today by, you know, making up topics out of thin air. So my question is there somebody out there who is for a protectorate? And if they are, and if there is somebody for this, who are they?
Okay. I think we have our four questions, better capacities, geographical factors, the agricultural sector, and who dreamed up the idea of the protectorate? who wants to start? Better capacities? Mauricio, give it a
I can try. Go if you want. Let me start with the last question. It's an interesting question. I, in preparing these comments, I read a lot of what's been written about Haiti. And I found a paper, or an article better, written by Peter Penn, at the National Enquirer.
Peter Pan.
When you read that paper, you realize that, to put it in the positive terms, there are a lot of people that are unhappy about the fact that there's been a lot of aid already going to Haiti in the past, not just as a result of the earthquake, but little has been achieved in terms precisely of developing state capacities and to promoting economic development in more general terms. So this idea of the UN trusteeship comes as an option to people that think that that really someone else should step in and take charge. And I think it so happens that we disagree and we want to propose something else, but that does not mean maybe we did not choose the right panel, but that does not mean that there are people out there proposing that. But let me make a comment on the other aspects that were mentioned, and particularly on this question of on the how-to that Patricia mentioned about developing state capacities. The graphical way of seeing these is relatively easy. The tax and custom administration fell to the ground. They need to rebuild the buildings. That happened to a lot of public institutions, the system of prisons that was just mentioned by Jean-Marie. So it's easy to imagine that will bring, you know, international contractors and local, you know, labor force to build this again. But what about the people? What about the people that used to run these agencies? What about the bureaucrats, the bureaucrats, the administrators? And those are the difficult questions. You know, a lot of people die, and particularly this was very severe in the case of the tax administration. And if you think about state capacities, what is the most important state capacity? I mean, the ability to collect taxes. And if you don't have that in place, what can you do? So we have to say something about how to recruit a new technocracy, which you cannot create it overnight. So maybe with this idea of the special agency or the special force, we have to think about bringing people that are going to be willing to work in Haiti for some time at the second, third, fourth level in the administrations in the administration of these entities, while there is, you know, training for public servants at that level in Haiti. So that's one very important question. On the issue of location, I think we also agree on the importance of rebalancing growth in Haiti in regional terms. The risks in Port-au-Prince are very high. But I think that the odds are, and that's why we have to think very hard about what to do, the odds are that this catastrophic event will reconcentrate things even more in Port-au-Prince. Mm. And that's a risk. That's a serious risk we have to assess. Why? Why do I think that? Well, because people will go to wherever there is employment, wherever there are income opportunities. And money is going to the reconstruction, the rebuilding. So that means that there is already, the UN is hiring people in Port-au-Prince, rightly so, to help remove materials, 75 cents an hour. They already hired 30,000 people, and more of that is going to happen, and more people are going to come from the rural side to get a job. So if we don't want the reconcentration of activities in Port-au-Prince, we have to think out of the box, and we have to think with ideas such as the special economic zones or issues that really kind of like act in a balancing way to that. And in terms of agriculture, there's one very nice a paper that's been put together by the Haitian government talking about the irony of the fact that the agricultural sector is in really bad shape in Haiti, And most of the food that is being delivered today to the people with this relief operation, it's imported. So how can we promote the idea that these donors use some local content? And I think that will be the starting point for the development of agriculture in Haiti, because today most of what's being handed out to people, most of what's being distributed, even water, it's imported.
Beth, your comments?
Let me respond to the question about reducing the risk of future disasters while rebuilding. You know, the whole field of disaster risk reduction has some good models for very concrete ways of protecting against the future risk of both hurricanes and earthquakes, which can and should be taken into account. But there's also the human element, and here, too, is the link with governance and capacity issues. I mean, if you compare the number of fatalities in Haiti and the four hurricane season 2008, it was 800 people, compared with Cuba, which had at least three of the same four hurricanes. The number of fatalities were four. It has a lot to do with the way in which response is organized and, again, the need to increase the capacity of the civil institutions to respond. And while I have the floor, if I could just say a word of caution about using the phrase or the concept of responsibility to protect. You know, that concept is already in trouble in terms of the growing criticism from certain parts of the world. And when it's applied to natural disaster situations, as it was by the French foreign minister in Cyclone Nargis in Burma and Myanmar a couple years ago, I mean, it generates even more suspicion and concern about it. So I think when we talk about international responsibility, it might be better just to stay away, tiptoe away from that phrase.
Jim Murray, any comments?
Well, on the capacity building, I think there's one interesting aspect in Haiti that exists in some other countries too, is because of the strength of local communities and also because of the great importance that the people attach in Haiti to education. Mm. I mean, even very poor Haitians will spend whatever money they have to send their children to school. Now, most of the schools don't do much more than keep the children during the school hours. And one has to think of models for building the state to where you take advantage of this commitment to education, of the fact that there are some structures that exist that are very weak, that you support them, but also you certify them, so that instead of having schools that do not educate, you have schools that give some education. But you don't try to build something in parallel when you have structures that already exist. Another point, rebuilding Haiti, Port-au-Prince, and I very much agree with what Mauricio said. And I would add that before the earthquake, the international effort was already enormously skewed in favor of Port-au-Prince. It's very hard to have NGOs, or the UN for that matter, present outside Port-au-Prince, because Port-au-Prince was more practical. I have no doubt that the bulk of the effort of the international community will unfortunately be skewed toward Port-au-Prince. And it has to be a very voluntary design to have a more balanced effort. On the question of an economic political elite, I think that's at the heart of the politics of Haiti, whether we are going to move away from kind of populist politics, where you can benefit from the knowledge that the economic elite has, but at the same time the economic elite opens up to a more generous agenda than what it has been used to. I think there it's a question of leadership by political leaders. You're not going to impose it from outside. But I think there is, in the face of such an immense tragedy, there is a possibility to evolve a bit the Haitian politics in a constructive way. There are a number of people in Haiti, I think, who are prepared for that. They need to be encouraged. They need to be supported. And it's not guaranteed it will happen, but if it does not happen, we'll continue to have the polarization that will, in the end, destroy whatever effort is made at this sort of infrastructural level.
Thank you. Just to add a point about this whole discussion about Port-au-Prince versus the rest, I'm surprised that no one has mentioned the fact that the rest of the country is environmentally degraded as very few places on Earth. It's pretty tough to scratch a living out there anyway.
It's true.
Let's take a couple more questions. Dan.
My name is Dan Erickson with Inter-American Dialogue. Everyone on the panel has really emphasized the need to work with the Haitian government. And presumably at some point that's going to involve elections. It was mentioned the parliamentary elections are delayed. René Préval, the current president, was due to have elections to replace him in November of this year.
Yeah.
And so my question is, amid all of this disaster relief and emphasis on recovery, where do you put new elections in Haiti as a priority? Thank you.
Okay. Over there.
Ana Paola Barbosa from the Embassy of Mexico. Before getting to what Mauricio is putting forth, the idea of creating a special agency, we have MINUSTAH on the ground. The troops and the forces have been increased recently, right after the yep. quake. My question is, I would like to know the Mr. Jean-Marie Guénot's opinion on expanding the mandate of MINUSTAH to provide the peacekeeping operation with more executive powers towards what Mauricio was proposing, and whether that's feasible inside the Security Council and vis-a-vis the Secretariat as well, because I don't see that much appetite going towards that direction.
And the last one, over there.
Hi, I'm Matt Rackety with Global Centurion. And I just have a real simple question. I know UNICEF has been raising alarms about potential human trafficking, especially child trafficking. Moving forward, how big an issue do you anticipate that being?
Thank you. So elections, expanding MINUSTAH, and child trafficking.
I'll take the child trafficking and leave the other questions. I think it's a huge issue. I think this is the largest child protection crisis we've seen in a long time. The number of kids who have been separated from family members, unaccompanied children, coupled with a culture with the rest of X system, which is a Haitian system in which children are placed to work in the homes of others, and it's been rampant, lots of exploitation and abuse. The whole situation of orphanages, the pressure for adoption, it's a huge issue. UNICEF, I think, is doing great work, but the last thing I read is they provided safe spaces for less than 1,000 kids, and you're talking about hundreds of thousands of potential difficult situations for children. So I think a lot more should be done. Military forces have been stationed at the airport to make sure that kids who get on planes are, in fact, supposed to be on those planes. The possibilities for large-scale trafficking and abuse within the country are tremendous.
Who wants elections?
Jean-Marie,
for sure.
No, not so sure. Elections. I'm both on the question of elections and on the mandate of MINUSTAH. I think these are questions that, as foreigners, we have to be very careful about deciding what is right. I think it has to, the decision that will be made need to result from intensive consultations with the Haitians. Of course, when you are presently sitting in the parliament, you just want to extend the present parliament. I think there is an interesting discussion to be had on probably some extension of the parliament, combined with a process to adjust, reform the institutions. Now, how that's a tricky political issue. I think it needs to be carefully tested with some Haitian interlocutors. If it was possible, I think it would be probably the most practical outcome. So not just extending the parliament, but having the assembly, but having to link it to the process of the reform of institutional reform. On the mandate of MINUSTAH, it's a bit the same thing. I think a Security Council that would adopt an all-encompassing mandate, that would come as a kind of imposition on the Haitian, that would not meet the test that we discussed earlier in the panel. I think having MINUSTAH and the head of MINUSTAH as a kind of orchestrator of the international effort makes a lot of sense, and so probably the mandate needs to be evolved. Now, there are sensitive issues. For instance, when you come to the security sector, there are practical issues, difficult practical issues, and sensitive issues. The difficult practical issues is that you can give a mandate to coordinate. Have no illusion. Coordination is always to coordinate, you have to be to have organizations and governments who are willing to be coordinated, and that's unusual. And so one has to be careful on how much the UN or any organization for that matter will be in a position to really coordinate. That's a practical issue that you see in Afghanistan, that you see everywhere. The sensitive issue is on security sector reform. I mean, the processes, and on the rule of law reform, the processes of vetting, the processes of vetting the police, vetting and even more difficult, vetting the judiciary, because it's a sovereign function, the judges. And so it's hard to imagine foreigners vetting judges. So you have to help consolidate a Haitian commission that does precisely that. And that has political support. That's all in the political footwork, so to speak, that you have to do that. So the mandate, it's important, but the implementation of the mandate is even more important. And I think the Security Council there is not the main obstacle. The real challenge is how you handle the negotiation with the Haitian government to have a mission with which they're comfortable, which is not perceived as overbearing, but that helps them consolidate their own institutions.
Thank you. Final word, Mauricio?
Well, just to add a little bit on this last topic, next week there is a meeting of the presidents of the Grupo de Rio. Grupo de Rio is a group of Latin American countries. They're going to meet in Cancun. And the topic is going to be the coordination of help vis-a-vis Haiti. There are different ideas. There's one idea of one group of countries that says that the Latin American countries should take charge of different sectors and different regions within Haiti. So say one country deals with hospitals, another country deals with schools. One country deals with Region A, another one deals with Region B. That's one idea. There's another idea, which is this special kind of like the administrator of this special agency, the MINUSTAH enhanced type of operation. I fully agree with Jean-Marie that enhanced operation should consider topics that are not too sensitive from the point of view of sovereignty. So it's not about appointing judges. It should be about, say, building roads and expanded mandate of MINUSTAH could come also with new leadership. By the way, we must include in the list of topics in this context the tensions that already existed between MINUSTAH and the government of Haiti. Mm-hmm. We should not pretend that this was a seamless operation, that there was tension and there was difficulty, but overall, it worked well. I mean, it gave Haiti, it's giving Haiti more security, which was, I guess, the largest issue, the largest problem. And finally, I think we have to acknowledge that there are many countries that are helping Haiti. And because of, say, the strong presence of one country, the U.S. or France, Sarkozy was there yesterday, that could have an impact on on these other countries. So this really has to be kept really in multilateral terms. Mm-hmm. Think, for example, that the first country to write off the debt of Haiti was Venezuela. Haiti owed Venezuela $300 million. And the first decision of the Venezuelan government was to wipe that out in January after the earthquake. The Cuban doctors are very important in Haiti, have been providing medical services in Haiti, are still providing medical services in Haiti, and that has to be preserved. So that balance is fundamental. And the very simple fact that the U.S. has already 17,000 troops in Haiti or off the coast of Haiti is something that creates attention. That's why it's very important that this operation at the multilateral level is really not only in the hands of the U.S., that there is another face to it, and that's why I think it's important to bring a leader from a developing country, let's say, that allows this conversation to be more to flow in better terms with the government of Haiti. So that's what I'll say.
If I may make one comment on one of your points, I mean, the possibility of distributing various countries taking one bit or another. I personally, I don't think it works very well. I mean, it was tested in a way in Afghanistan. It doesn't work well because, I mean, some countries do a good job, others don't, but nobody dares say it. And so you get stuck with one particular sector where nothing is happening because of national pride. And so it's a very risky proposition. I mean, it looks good, but it assumes that every country is going to do a good job, and it never happens that way.
I couldn't agree more. I fully agree.
Okay. Well, that was terrific. I certainly hope that this won't be the last panel that we have on Haiti. I mean, one of the tragedies of these things is that disasters come and go, and we all get, you know, hyped up, and then the country vanishes from the headlines. I certainly hope that this won't be the case with Haiti. I certainly hope that we will be able to summon you to future panels on Haiti. I certainly hope that the next panel will be as good as this one. So I will ask you to join me, in giving a warm round of applause.